Okay, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we have a very special opportunity to give a shir le'ilui ha'neshama for Meir ben Mordechai Azriel. His neshama should have an aliyah from our Divrei Torah, and I wanted to share a few words about this opportunity that we all have together. Unfortunately, it means a tremendous amount to me that you made an effort to come today and participate in the shir. I'm sure it's incredibly difficult after suffering such a catastrophic loss, such a tragedy of something we should never know of. But unfortunately for most of us in the room, we did not know Meir, and we did not have the opportunity to appreciate all of his qualities and the lifetime that he lived. The little research that I was able to do, and I spoke to a few people who had heard about him, it sounded like he was a man who was a young man, but a man who really gave so much of himself for other people. And that's why today's shir, I really want to give in tribute to his neshama. Today's shir is about Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos, and somebody who is a member of Hatzalah, and has to be, if we can even call it, Bimachal Shabbos, what that perspective should be of such an individual. Meir was a person who gave of himself in that way. Meir was a person who gave of himself in so many other ways. And that's why I want to talk about that. But unfortunately, for those of us who didn't really get to know him, Bechayev, in his life, we are faced with a very difficult challenge. How do you really, after a person is no longer here, how do you begin to appreciate what they're all about? And for that, as we know, there are very few words that can ever be shared that are really of meaning when we talk about such a topic. But I just want to give out, sometimes it's easier to read somebody else's words and try to find meaning in them or try to find some comfort or some understanding. So I have two passages here that I photocopied from two different writings of Rav Soloveitchik. And here Rav Soloveitchik talks about what it felt like in his life when he suffered loss and what that feeling meant to him. And just before we get into the Divrei Torah today, I want to maybe just read through this to give us a little bit of an understanding of a picture of what loss feels like and what, unfortunately, the world is missing once we have somebody like Meir who is no longer with us. So let's begin with the first one. And that is a very meaningful passage that he wrote, that he spoke about also very often, after he lost his wife. Now, Rav Soloveitchik considered himself to be the luckiest man in the world. He had a wife who he absolutely adored and was so close to, and they were together on every level, on intellectual levels and on every other level that a husband and wife can be together, and they shared so much in common. And here, after his wife passed away, he went into almost a deep depression, and he had a very difficult time trying to figure out how he was going to move on and what he was going to do. So let's read this passage together. He says, "The longing for one who has died and is gone forever is worse than the torment of the depth of the grave. The soul is overcome and shattered by fierce longing for the departed, and all of us who are left behind are just trying to grapple with the reality that we're now found in. Before this Rosh Hashanah, and as we know, whenever we lose somebody who is close to us, there are different times in the year, different episodes that make us feel the loss even more profoundly than we otherwise would have. Before this Rosh Hashanah, in my mind, I saw my father, the Gaon Rav Moshe Soloveitchik of blessed memory, standing before me. He was the only Rebbe and teacher I ever had. I opened my heart to him and I said, 'My father, my master, I have so many new insights that I have developed on the laws of the temple sacrifices on Yom Kippurim, on the topic of mitzvahs lav lehenes nitnu, and on the laws of blowing the shofar. I have so much to talk about now that we're in the season of Rosh Hashanah. I've had so many new novel insights that I'd love to share with you and discuss. And on the laws of blowing the shofar, I have ideas that would have pleased you and brought you enjoyment, some that you would not have accepted and would have refuted. But that's part of the love that I shared with you, that we were able to discuss it, that we were able to have a conversation. That is how I spoke to my father in my vision. Although I knew that I would never receive a response to my words, and so often that's something that we try to do. We try to communicate with those who are no longer here and who unfortunately are not with us and we cannot any longer communicate with. And unfortunately we find ourselves often not getting a response. Oh, how much I would give to exchange words of Torah with my father for only 5 minutes. And think about how much we should appreciate those who still are in our lives, that we have the ability to spend those 5 minutes and appreciate what they mean to us and what value they bring to our lives. And how often we don't recognize it until unfortunately it's too late. And here says Rav Soloveitchik, I would give everything in the world just to have another 5 minutes with my own father, and we know that to be true with any relationship that we have. But I know that this man who loved me so much and whom I am so close with, to is now so distant. My heart breaks with longing to speak with him for only 5 minutes, a period of time which we did not know how to properly value when he was still with us. And Rav Soloveitchik is teaching us that when, unfortunately, as a community, we go through a loss, and as friends of the Weiss family, we have all been through a loss, and we're all suffering together. But when we go through such a thing, it gives us an opportunity to reconfigure the proper value of time, the proper relationships that we do have and that we're so blessed to have in life, and what we're supposed to do with those relationships and those moments. The same is true regarding my mother and my wife. A few days ago, I was writing this annual sermon on repentance. I always used to talk it with my wife. She would help me develop and polish my ideas. Again this year, while I was writing this lecture, I wanted to ask her, could you please help me? Should I shorten this idea? Should I expand on this point? Should I stress this concept or another one? I asked my wife, but there was no response. If there was a reply, it was lost in the rustling of the trees, and it did not reach me. So, number one, when we come together to commemorate a tragic, a catastrophic loss like the one that we are commemorating today, the Shloshim is today, if I'm not mistaken, tonight. As we said, his neshama should have a tremendous aliyah. But it gives us an opportunity to refocus. It gives us an opportunity as a community to think about how much blessing the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us in our lives and how much we just need to begin to appreciate it. And unfortunately, sometimes those 5 minutes are something that we do not give enough attention to. But now that we have an opportunity to do so, we have the chance to take something away from this very untimely and tragic circumstance, and at least to take something home away, that it should be a schus for his aliyas haneshama, that we continue to grow in our own lives. One final point that I want to bring out about that is what Rav Soloveitchik wrote in the book Man of Faith in the Modern World. So he writes the following: man is usually late in his value judgments. His appreciation of persons, things, and events is a product of hindsight. In retrospection, man discovers the precise value of someone who was but is no longer with him. That's the reality of life, and we all know that to be true. This delayed understanding and appreciation is painfully tragic. While the departed was near and we could communicate, we were only partially perceptive of his identity. Our awareness of his specialness as someone vital and precious to us comes at the very instant he departs and withdraws into the mist of remoteness. Only then do we inquire with painful longing, who was he who brightened my days? What did he mean to me? Why do I feel so bereft and disoriented now that the person is no longer here? What treasures we would now readily expend for only 5 minutes with them to open our hearts and minds to them, to make amends, to say what was left unsaid, and to do what had been neglected. And that, I think, if we can walk away with just a few lessons from the life of giving that Meir was, from those who were closest to him, from his family members who have said so much about him. His father just told us an amazing story, which I'm just saying over on his behalf, that last year he was driving up to the mountains with a family member, and he passed by a 7-Eleven on the highway, and the other passenger in the car made a comment that, look, there's a 7-Eleven. As we all know, 7-Eleven serves Slurpees, and that's a very important stop for many people along the way. And another member of the family who was in the car made such a comment. And he got off the highway and he turned around and he went way out of his way to go back to that 7-Eleven that he had missed. And she turned to him and she said, it's just a Slurpee. Why are you going so far out of your way? Why do you have to turn your car around? He said, because if I can take a few dollars to make somebody else smile and make somebody else happy, that's worth the whole world. And if that can encapsulate the life of a young person, that says it all. That's what life is all about. Making other people smile. There's an amazing Gemara. The Gemara tells us in Masechet Shabbos, if I'm not mistaken, that one of the Tanoim once bumped into Eliyahu HaNavi. He has a conversation with Eliyahu HaNavi and he asks him, they're walking through the marketplace, and he says, is there anybody here who's a member of Olam Haba, of the world to come? He starts pointing at this one and that one and the other one, and it seems that Eliyahu HaNavi is declining all of them. It seems that none of them are worthy of being members of Olam Haba, till finally he meets two people standing in the side of the marketplace, and he says, those two people are the ones who are going straight to the world to come, straight to Olam Haba. And the question is, he turns back to Eliyahu HaNavi. He says, those two people, they don't seem like the leaders of the community. They don't seem like they contribute too much. Why are they the ones that you feel are worthy of Olam Haba?
Lawyers.
And Eliyahu HaNavi turns back to him and he says, because their job is to make other people smile. Their job is to be the leitzan of the community, to be the person who is responsible to make others happy. And that's an incredible job. And if somebody lives life with a perspective like that, said Eliyahu HaNavi, that's an automatic ticket to Olam Haba. And when I heard this story just now, I was reminded of that Maimer Chazal, of that story in the Gemara, because that's what life is all about. If we can say what our mission here is in life, there are so many different venues that people choose in which they're going to spend their lives, but there's no greater mission, there's no greater value than to bring meaning to the life of others, to bring happiness, to bring joy, to bring simcha, and meaning that will carry them throughout their lives and make their lives much different than they would have otherwise been before they had met you. And that really was the life of Meir in so many different ways. And the camp that he was involved in, how much he got involved with the kids, and how much he pushed them to push themselves to perfect their lives and to do better. What he did for the members of Hatzalah and for the members of the community that needed his help and his assistance was legendary. It was something that, although, as we said, he was a young man, it was something that should not be taken for granted. It was amazing how much he helped other people and how much he put of himself out there. So, with that brief introduction, and with our hope, with our prayer, with our tefillah, that Meir's neshama should have an aliyah and his family should only have besuras tovas going forward. They should only have wonderful things in the family. Many celebrations together. God willing, there will be a wedding that we will all celebrate together. If we're here together in the painful times, we absolutely will be here in the celebrations as well, together with your entire family. And we give you a bracha, bila hamavas lanetzach, umacha Hashem dima me'al kol panim v'nomar amen. So let's begin today's topic with a Gemara Maseches Yuma daf pehe. And by way of introduction to that Gemara, we are told that we have 613 mitzvahs in the Torah. And the question is, sometimes you have a conflict in which you have to make a decision what you're going to do. So the Gemara tells us, what happens when you have a conflict, when a person's life is in danger? For example, somebody finds himself in, take for example, the most common example that we thought about 70 years ago was the concentration camp. And so much literature has been written about it. So here's somebody who's, God forbid, in the concentration camp, has no food, and the only food they can find is non-kosher food. And we're not talking about something that's maybe rabbinically non-kosher. We're talking about something that's biblically non-kosher, absolutely non-kosher at all. Milk and meat cooked together, that's the only item of food they can get their hands on. So the question asked the Gemara is, what am I supposed to do? On the one hand, I have God telling me, you're supposed to listen to the laws of the Torah. You have to eat kosher. On the other hand, if I follow the rules of the Torah under these conditions, in this circumstance, I'm not going to be able to survive, because there's nothing else here that can sustain me. So the Gemara says clearly, unequivocally, that the rule, the guiding principle in any such circumstance is, Yavor ve'al yeharik. Do not give up your life in order to perform the mitzvah that God asks you to do. You have a mitzvah to keep God's commandments. You are supposed to, and you are expected to keep His commandments, but to a point. If it gets to a level where a person simply cannot survive, one would assume that I have no obligation to perform that mitzvah, and one should rather violate the mitzvah than to give up their life. However, the Gemara says there are three notable exceptions. And those three notable exceptions are what we call the cardinal sins. So that is Avodah Zarah, if a person is being asked to serve idol worshiping, and the other choice is to give up my life, says the Gemara, you have to be willing to give up your life. Shvichas Damim, if a person is asked to go and murder somebody else, directly be involved in the murder of another individual, then we say, when you have a choice, either someone's going to kill me, unless I kill you, I don't have a right to take the life of somebody else, I have to be willing to give up of my own life. And finally, the Gemara says the third example is Gilui Arayos. If I am told that I have to go ahead and violate a inappropriate activity in areas of sexuality, the Gemara says a person has to be willing to give up their life instead of violating that principle. And there's a major question that's discussed amongst the Rishonim. What does it mean that I have to be willing to give up my life? I'm sorry, that I have to be willing to give up my life in those cases instead of violating the Aveir? Does that mean only in the case where somebody holds a gun to my head and they say, either you violate that or I'm going to kill you? That's the time where the Gemara says I have to be willing to give up my life for those three cardinal sins. Or does it mean a greater extension of that as well? For example, does it also mean that a person who sees that they have a very difficult inclination towards something that is evil. So say, for example, something pushes me that I feel such an inclination to serve Avodah Zarah, to serve idol worshiping. Something is pushing me, I have such a raging temptation for a member of the opposite gender, and there's nothing that can stop me from wanting to do the act that I want to commit. Now I know in my mind this is not something I should be doing. I know it's something that I should absolutely stay away from, but there's no way of me holding myself back. Do I have to commit suicide in order not to violate that? Is that what the Torah demands of me as well? Or do we assume, no, the Torah just means that if somebody else threatens my life and asks, either you do X or I kill you, I have to be willing to take that choice over violating God's commandment. That's a major discussion, and unfortunately it came up in the 1500s, 1400s, in the days of the Balei HaTosis, where they discussed that their children were going to be taken away at a very young age, and they said there was no way that the young children would have the ability to withstand the temptations of Avodah Zarah in a later stage in life. There was no way. And many of the Balei HaTosis felt, we should murder our children rather than them falling into the hands of those who are going to make them do something of that nature, which is such a profoundly painful discussion to have. And it's such a profoundly painful thought process that they needed to go to. And there were many of the Balei HaTosis who actually murdered their own children in order that their children shouldn't be faced with that temptation that they would not be able to withstand. The overwhelming opinion amongst the Rishonim was that that was the wrong perspective. That is not proper. And the proper perspective is when a person is faced with that situation, and my life is being threatened unless I violate this prohibition, so that's the only time when a person has to give up their life. But in a general circumstance, we don't assume that a person has to be willing to commit suicide as not to violate that aveira. So we have those kinds of categories. Now, says the Gemara,
also, didn't they become murderers themselves? They made the choice for somebody else.
Correct. So that was also one of the issues. What right do I have to make a choice for my child? Maybe if it's talking about me personally, that's one thing, but how can I make a choice for my child? Maybe when they grow up, they will be able to withstand the temptation. Maybe they will have the stamina from somewhere. Maybe God will help them out. Again, this was a very complicated discussion, and that's why we generally do not assume that that is the adopted opinion. Happens to be somebody called me up recently that they have a certain challenge in life. We won't go into the details, but they have a certain challenge in life. And he was talking to me on the phone for a long time, and he said he has this challenge that really is a tremendous temptation of his to do one of these three cardinal sins. And he said he really feels he's at a point in life where he won't be able to hold himself back anymore. He's going to have to violate, given the circumstance that he happens to be in, very unfortunately. And he asked me, what is my obligation? What is my obligation? Is my obligation to willingly give up my life to commit suicide before I come to violate that prohibition? Is that what the Torah demands of me? And I was amazed on so many levels by that question. I was amazed because, number one, that a person who's struggling so much, a person who sees that they have this temptation that they cannot resist, is willing to ask such a question, is really willing to consider it. So I got into a discussion with him about what the Rishonim say, and this happens not to be the Psak. We don't generally assume that a person is obligated to do that, but I was just amazed by the Jewish people. Look how a Jew thinks. Look what a Jew is worried about. It's an amazing thing. And I said to him, I think you're a hero, that you have resisted such a temptation for the longest time. Now that you feel you're not going to be able to resist anymore, you're calling to ask a question about how you should handle that? I'm not sure if I was ever faced with such a challenge, with such a temptation, that I would have that perspective. And I was amazed with this person. We had a long conversation about it, but it was a very unfortunate one. So the Gemara here has a discussion in Maseches Yuma. What about the laws of Shabbos? So what happens if I have a situation where I have a toss-up, I have a dilemma? Either I can keep to the laws of Shabbos, or I can make sure that I look after my life. So a person has a medical emergency on Shabbos, but by tending to the medical emergency, I'm going to have to violate the laws of Shabbos. So what do I do, asked the Gemara? What is my obligation? What am I supposed to do? Which one is more important? It's not that we don't value life. We do value life, but we value Shabbos also. And the question that the Gemara asks is, well, which one takes precedence? Which one is more important? Is Shabbos more important, or is Jewish life more important? So the Gemara comes to the conclusion, Jewish life is absolutely more important, because the Pasuk says, V'chai bohem v'lo sheyamus bohem, which means we have an obligation to keep to all the laws of the Torah, and we should live by them. We should continue to have the opportunity to live by the laws of the Torah. And therefore, the Gemara comes to the conclusion that whenever we have a toss-up between Jewish life and violating a law of the Torah, we assume Jewish life comes first. And that includes violating, desecrating the Shabbos as well. So we will do, based on this Gemara, whatever it takes to save a human life on Shabbos, whether or not we have to violate a lot of the laws of Shabbos, or we don't have to violate a lot of laws of Shabbos, just one or two, we would say violate whatever you have to do. Now, I just came back from a very intense 2 weeks. I was asked this summer to be the rabbi in Camp Simcha. Now, for those who may not know, Camp Simcha is a sacred haven for heroic children who are battling various variations of cancer. And it's a painful place to be because you watch how these children struggle through getting by the mundane routine activities of a day. And it's unbelievable to see what is done for these children. Now, one of the challenges that the camp has is there are literally life and death questions that come up every single day. And I felt that I was completely inadequate to be there. I felt very uncomfortable that we were being faced with many, many challenges while I was there in the 2 weeks that were very critical challenges and very major problems. But one issue that came up was on one of the Shabbosos that I was there, there was a medical emergency that transpired, and it was clear that Chilul Shabbos needed to be done, and serious Chilul Shabbos was going to be necessary. Now again, based on the Gemara, this is what we do. We're Mechallel Shabbos, we go and we do whatever has to be done. We drive in the car, we get as many people as we think are necessary, and that's what's done. Now, I was asked to come along because they thought it was important that I come. Now, I have no medical expertise at all. I have no medical experience at all. I didn't feel that I am someone who can really be helpful, but if that's what the patient feels is going to help them out, if that's what the patient feels is going to make them more comfortable, my obligation as a person who has no medical knowledge, but to make that person feel comfortable and to make their condition be even slightly better, my obligation is to be Mechallel Shabbos for that as well. And I went in the car and I went along with them to do whatever had to be done because I felt that was the right thing to do. That's what the Gemara says has to be done. And this is a general question that we need to ask ourselves. When and how do we draw the line when we talk about who is necessary to come along when Pikuach Nefesh is warranted on Shabbos? When saving a life is something that we absolutely must do, how far can we take that? So let's say you have a woman who's in labor on Shabbos. Obviously, we should not delay. We take her to the hospital immediately. You don't waste time because you never know. You never know what's going to happen. So you take the woman immediately. Now, let's say on the way, the woman says, you know, it would make my labor much more comfortable if you picked up my mother. It would make me much more comfortable if you picked up this one or that one. So it has to be really determined. Is this something that's really going to help her? Or is it something that she's just saying and it's not really going to make a difference? And if that's the case, where do we draw the line? Let's say the woman gets up and she says, you know, I'd like you to rent a bus and bring the whole neighborhood with me to the hospital. So at what point do we say, you know, that's a little bit out of control, and that's something that we should not accept? Another question that came up in Camp Simcha, which is relevant to this as well, is unfortunately we have a lot of campers there. Not a lot, but there are a number of them who are on active chemo, and the side effects of that which they're going through is very painful. And as a result, they don't eat a lot of food, they don't have an appetite, and they're feeling queasy very often, and there are very limited numbers or elements of food that they're able to eat and they're able to absorb. And the question is, it comes Shabbos and we thought they were going to eat whatever we serve, and it turns out they refuse to eat that. So we had a girl who comes into the kitchen and says, I just cannot eat this. I'm not feeling well, and there's very limited numbers of food I can take in. And she comes and she asks that she would like us to make her a raw steak, you know, to cook up a raw steak on Shabbos because that's the only thing she can eat, or to make a hamburger, or to make something that she'll be comfortable with. Now, we made a determination based on the doctors and the medical professionals that were there that, yes, this girl is in a situation where the food that we have is just not going to do it for her. And we don't have an obligation to hook her up to IV. We have an obligation to make her feel comfortable because she's in a situation where her life is in a precarious state. And given that reality, we have to do whatever we can to make her feel comfortable. Now, does that mean if a girl comes to us on Shabbos and says, you know, I'd like to go out on the motorboat, so we're going to take her? Probably not. But if a girl comes to us and says, look, there's nothing really that I can eat. I'm not comfortable with any of the food that's being served here. And I think that this is what's necessary for myself to be healthy and make it through the day. That's absolutely what we are going to do. And this is something that needs to be thought about very carefully. And the Shulchan Aruch quotes this lahalacha, and the Shulchan Aruch says, if somebody is faced with a situation of pikuach nefesh on Shabbos, the Shulchan Aruch says, Not only are you not being Mechal HaShabbos, but mitzvah hu dekaavid. You are performing the greatest activity, the greatest mitzvah. Why? Because you're involved in saving a life. And what can be greater than that? What can God want more than that? Yes, Shabbos is important and all the mitzvahs are important. All the things God asks us to do are of great central focus to all of us. However, Jewish life comes before almost everything else. And therefore, says the Shulchan Aruch, anyone who's involved in saving a life on Shabbos is not only not being Mechal HaShabbos, but he is actually involved in one of the greatest mitzvahs. Now, says the Shulchan Aruch, what happens in a situation where I hear that there was a big accident, I hear on the radio, and now I go and I run to the scene, I'm driving my car, I get there, it turns out it was nothing. Somebody just needed a Band-Aid. The whole situation was under control. I wasn't needed at all. My Chilul Shabbos turns out that it wasn't warranted at all. Does it turn out that now I need to do tshuva because I was Mechal HaShabbos? Says the Shulchan Aruch, no. Because you thought you were going to save a life. And you were under the impression that your medical expertise would be helpful. And therefore what you did was something that was a mitzvah. It's not your fault at all. And says the Shulchan Aruch, no tshuva necessary at all because you did the right thing. So there's a contemporary question that is discussed. Let's say we have a number of members of Hatzalah. So we get a call, goes out on the radio, the dispatcher lets us know, big accident, we need, you know, a whole bunch of paramedics to come. So everybody drops whatever they're doing, they run to the call, and they do whatever has to be done. First member of Hatzalah gets there, he sees there are already 10 paramedics here. We don't need everybody else. So the question is raised, and it's a very contemporary question. Should he radio back to his fellow Hatzalah members and tell them, no need to drive your cars anymore, stop wherever you are, turn back around and go back home? Why? Because we don't need you. Well, that will entail him being Mechal HaShabbos because he has to get on the phone or the radio and call back to everybody and say, stop whatever you're doing, we don't need you anymore. Or should he just allow them to continue along the way because after all, they think they're involved in saving a life. They don't know that the situation is already under control. So should we assume that when you have a situation like that, we should just let everyone keep on going because after all, they're not really being Mechal HaShabbos, they think they're doing a mitzvah. But by him making the phone call, he is being Mechal HaShabbos. Now, somebody pointed out to me that it happens to be, I'll take your question in a minute, somebody did point out to me that it happens to be every time a Hatzalah member is rushing to a call, it is a situation of Pikuach Nefesh for himself. Because he's running red lights and he's going faster over the speed limit and he's not using his fair judgment as he otherwise would have. So, you have to take that into consideration also. If that's something that we need to worry about, that by him running to the call or rushing to the call and driving in perhaps a way that he otherwise would not have driven, maybe that's something that certainly you have to call back to him when he's not needed anymore because he might be putting himself in danger. But leaving that factor aside, this is a very important question. Should we assume that because everybody is driving out to the call and because everybody who's going assumes that they're doing something which is warranted, they're doing something which is their mitzvah to be done right now, maybe we should assume that's not called a desecration of Shabbos at all and they're allowed to continue going and nobody should radio ahead to them? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or nothing additional can be done by these other people, then I would think that,
meaning then they're not going to be available if there's an emergency,
right?
Here
you're calling on East 79th Street, somebody's on West 79th Street. So it's a Pikuach Nefesh issue because the whole idea of the Hatzalah thing is that you don't know when somebody's going to call for help, so that's
correct.
Somebody ready, willing, and able to go is.
So that's very correct. There is a very important discussion. The greats of the last generation discussed it. When you have, let's say, a Hatzalah member goes to the hospital on Shabbos, is he allowed to return? And they had a very detailed discussion based on a Gemara in Maseches Beitza. How do you understand it? Whether or not we should assume that the same way you have a right to go on the call, so do you have a right to come back? This was very richly debated. But part of the discussion needs to be that if we only have a limited number of volunteers in the neighborhood, and by sending somebody off to the hospital, and now they're going to be stuck there for the rest of Shabbos, now we're going to be down a member, and if somebody has an emergency here, they're not going to be able to be tended to, that certainly needs to be taken into very serious consideration. Then it's Pikuach Nefesh in the other direction. For them not to come back is jeopardizing the lives of those in the community who are left behind and who now don't have the service of that individual. Yeah.
That's for Hatzalah, that's not for...
Correct. So that's a very correct point. Yeah. And that's a point that many people are not aware of.
Yeah.
So, you're very correct in saying that that's only for a Hatzalah member who thinks that by coming back they're going to be able to enhance the lives of others. But let's say you just have somebody goes in, their child has a broken bone, something happens, and now they let you out on Shabbos afternoon. Who said you have a right to come back now? Just because it's more comfortable at home doesn't mean you have a right to be Mechal HaShabbos to make it home. So that's a good point that you raise. Now, These questions are very difficult and very complicated, but the Ramban and the Ran both write the following. They say, let's say you have somebody who decides, you know what, I value Shabbos so much and I love Shabbos so much, I don't want to go on the call. I don't want to be Mechal Shabbos. I don't want to drive in the car. I would rather not have to do that. Says the Ramban, Hareze Chasidus Shel Shtus. That is a silliness. That's not a choice you should be making. That is the wrong choice to be making. That is not somebody who's pious. That is somebody who has a misunderstanding of what human life is all about. And therefore, says the Ramban, you have no right to do that. And he says, Bidino Kishofech Damim. You have a similar status to somebody who is an accomplice to murder. Why? Because by you delaying, by you not responding to the call, by you not driving the family member to the hospital that absolutely needs to go to the hospital, you are perhaps jeopardizing their life, and says the Ramban, minutes count. You never know, by delaying, by thinking twice, by going and asking a question, you never know if a person is really going to be jeopardizing the life of others. You never know if you're going to be jeopardizing your own life. And therefore, says the Ramban, you don't have a right to make that choice. You don't have a right to say, well, I'm going to keep Shabbos and I'm not going to respond because Shabbos means more to me than Jewish life. In fact, the Magen Avraham quotes a very similar comment in the name of the Radvaz. The Magen Avraham, one of the foremost commentators on Shulchan Aruch, quotes one of the earlier sources which writes the following, that let's say you have a situation. Sometimes you have a medical condition where it's not clear that anyone who's in this kind of condition would want to have treatment done to them. Sometimes it's going to be a prolonged suffering. Sometimes they'll rather just say, you know what, I'd rather not take the treatment. I'll just die peacefully. I don't want this. Sometimes that's the scenario. In that case, says the Magen Avraham, we have no right to convince the person otherwise. If that's the choice that you make under the circumstances, that's the right you have, being the person in charge of your own life. However, says the Magen Avraham, what if you have a situation in the other direction? Somebody has a very classical illness that we know how to deal with, and the doctors are pretty confident that you're going to go through this and this treatment, but then you're going to get out of it and you're going to get better, like 99% of the people in the world get better. So therefore, says the Magen Avraham, let's say the patient gets up and he says, totally irrationally, but the patient gets up and he says, you know what, I'm not interested. I don't want to be treated. I'll die from the illness. I don't want the doctors getting involved at all. I'd rather just suffer and die, and I don't want to have any interventions done for me. Says the Magen Avraham, we as a community don't have a right to accept the wishes of that person because it's totally unreasonable. The same way over here, a person who gets him and says, I don't want to be Mechal Shabbos because Shabbos means more to me, we don't have a right to accept that because that's unreasonable. So too over here, says the Magen Avraham, if you have a person who's faced with a very preliminary condition that most people in the world would say, of course I want it to be treated, says the Magen Avraham, you don't have a right to say, I don't want the treatment. I refuse to accept the treatment because after all, says the Magen Avraham, that's something that is unacceptable. Jewish life is Jewish life. And you do not have the right just to say, well, I make a decision that I'm not interested in that and therefore I shouldn't be doing it. So this is something that we have to take in the proper perspective. And therefore, says the Shulchan Aruch and the Magen Avraham, when you have a situation on Shabbos that presents itself, don't feel bad about the fact that you're being Mechal Shabbos, so to speak, to take care of this ill person. That's your obligation. And we would force a person to go and run to that call. We would make the person do it. In fact, the Rambam writes, when you have a situation like that, the Rambam tells us, don't go and run to find the non-Jew to do it on your behalf. You should do it. And he says, Al Yidei HaGdolim. Many people say that means, it means the role models of the community should be at the forefront of this initiative. When they see that there's a pikuach nefesh that presents itself on Shabbos, they should be the ones running in front of everybody else to save the person's life and to be involved in any way that they can, because this is something that we value. This is something that means so much to us. This is the most important value in the Jewish community, and therefore we assume that this is something we should all run to do. And therefore we should never feel uncomfortable if we are faced with that circumstance. We should never feel bad about it. It's something that we have an obligation to do. Yeah?
How do you determine sometimes pikuach nefesh? You know, sometimes it's very clear with childbirth, but sometimes it's not, you know.
Right, so sometimes pikuach nefesh is not clear at all.
Who thinks that for them, or is it, you know?
So that's a very difficult question. How do you balance, how do you really figure out what is pikuach nefesh and what is not? And that's a very difficult thing to really figure out, and how do we regulate that? Now, take for example, you know, my father always gives the example. You have somebody who gets an ingrown toenail. So it's true for a diabetic or somebody who has a major problem, you know, some major illness, an ingrown toenail could be fatal. Every 100 years somebody might die from such a thing. But that's unusual, meaning we know if it was a regular day of work and you woke up in the morning, you had an ingrown toenail, you wouldn't take off the day to go get it taken care of. You'd say, okay, I'll wait till Sunday, I'll wait till Friday, I have some time, I'll go to the doctor, I'll have it taken care of. Yes, you're right. Every once in a 100 years, something happens that is very unusual. We don't call that pikuach nefesh. The Chasam Sofer writes, when it's echad mine elef alfi alef, when you have something which is so unlikely that it's going to really lead to a pikuach nefesh, one in a million, he says that's not really called something we should be concerned about. But when you have something that is borderline, or if you have something that is even over borderline, but something that is of concern, we definitely should not be taking chances. We should be running immediately to take care of it.
And a lot of times when the oven, you know, sometimes when the oven goes out, the lights, some people try to get someone to turn it off, you know, because of carbon monoxide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so I'll tell you something,
it's not
you know,
immediate. It's not like
I'll make a little confession. So here I was in Camp Simcha, and one day, one Shabbos afternoon, there was a situation where the air conditioning went out in one of the bunks. So you say, okay, the air conditioning went out, right? What's the big deal? So the big deal is that it's boiling hot in the summer, and you're dealing with cancer patients who are on active chemo. So was that really pikuach nefesh? Hard to determine, right? Very hard to determine. So I was presented with this question. What do we do? What do we do about this? So the question is as follows. Do I go ahead and have one of the Jewish counselors who's in the bunk just flip the switch, do it with a shinui, maybe do it indirectly, but you'll have... ostensibly, the Jewish counselor is going to violate Shabbos by turning on the air conditioner. Or should we run around the camp for 15, 20 minutes looking for the woman who's cleaning a toilet somewhere, who's the non-Jewish Mexican woman who happens to be working there? Maybe we should stop her from what she's doing to come and turn on the air conditioner. So what would you say? Would you say that waiting another 20 minutes is pikuach nefesh? That's very tough. It's a very tough decision. Now, if it's going to take you 20 minutes to figure out the psak, you may as well just get the non-Jew. But that's why we have to know these halachas well, and we have to be aware of what we're supposed to do and how we should respond immediately. So they asked me this question. So what are you supposed to do? So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, number one, if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you certainly have no obligation to go and wake up a non-Jew to do something of that nature. Even though it's easy to get a non-Jew, he says you don't have to go and wake up the non-Jew and inconvenience them to come and do this for you. If it's in the middle of the day and you can easily get a non-Jew to do it instead of you and it will take just an extra 10 seconds, no big deal, so he may as well do that. But he says, if it's going to be such an inconvenience, that's something I do not have an obligation to do. However, what if we're talking about my case? 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Shabbos afternoon. I can easily go and get a non-Jew, but it's going to take another 20 minutes. So I said, I think, given the medical knowledge that I was told by the doctors and the medical professionals in camp, I was told that someone overheating when going through a situation like that, when in active chemo, can be very dangerous, and therefore we should have the Jew turn it on with a shinui. That's what I told him to do, and that's what we did. And I was feeling very guilty all week about the fact that I had said that, because I really wasn't sure. That was one of those borderline cases. Are you really clear that that's called a pikuach nefesh? Can you really say that? 20 minutes, would it really made a difference? Hard to know. I was feeling very guilty until Thursday afternoon in camp, the air conditioning goes out in the dining room in the middle of supper. So here we are, we're all in the middle of dinner, hundreds of kids in the dining room, it's boiling hot in there, and two kids passed out, and one of them almost died. And I said, this was the Ribbono Shel Olam, she's okay, but it was the Ribbono Shel Olam sending me a message and saying, you made the right decision, you made the right choice, because look what happened. What? No, whatever, there was a storm, whatever it may have been, but it wasn't their fault, but that's what happened. And they came, and they got a company to come put in an air conditioning, whatever it was, but I said this was God talking to me and saying, don't make fun. Don't take chances on Shabbos. You made the right decision. It was the right thing. So again, not every scenario is the same, and you have to judge and evaluate each one carefully. But you can't spend a half an hour trying to judge, because here we were for 15 minutes in the dining room boiling hot, and look what happened. Two kids whose immune systems are down really got affected very negatively as a result of that. Yeah?
So if it's, in fact, a pikuach nefesh, why would you have to send someone else to do it? Why do you need a shinui? You should just go yourself and do it.
I would have done it myself. I didn't know where the bunk was.
And
of course.
For the shinui.
So a shinui, again, if you can very easily do it with a finger that you otherwise wouldn't use, or the back of your hand, it's not going to take any more time. So if you're talking about, let's say, some of the machines in camp that they have to use on Shabbos, let's say feeding tubes, things like that, and you have to press all kinds of buttons, I wouldn't advise that they do it with a shinui. Certainly, you know, Rav Asher Weiss once told me, I wouldn't advise that a doctor who has to go to the hospital on Shabbos drives with a shinui. You don't drive with your legs instead of your hands. It's probably not a good idea. So a shinui is something that always knocks a malacha down. A biblical prohibition on Shabbos is knocked down to the level of being rabbinic if you do it in an indirect or unusual manner. So that's why if it's just as simple to turn on the air conditioner with the back of your hand as it is to flip the switch with your finger, so I would advise that that's what should be done.
This seems a little inconsistent, though. It seems because you say if it's really pikuach nefesh, you should run and do it. If that is the mitzvah. You should have no reservation about doing
correct.
It.
Correct. That's correct.
With a shinui or without a shinui.
Again, if there's no difference, if it's not going to make a difference, so you may as well do it with a shinui. But if you think there's going to be a time lapse, or you think you're not going to do it responsibly, let's say you have to press buttons on the feeding tube, and you're not going to do it the way it has to be done, I told him, absolutely, you should do it with a shinui. Rav Asher Weiss told me also, interestingly, that he thought a shinui is also, if you use a thimble, you use something on your finger, and you're not doing it directly with your finger, that's also called a shinui. Whatever you're going to come up with. But again, if that's going to cause a time delay, that might be a critical time delay. If it's going to cause something to be, you know, not the way it should be, so then obviously we wouldn't take chances and we would not delay at all. So that was what I said, and I was very, it was unfortunate that I had to see that two girls suffered as a consequence of the air conditioning in the dining room going out, but for me, it was a gratifying feeling to see that God sent me a message. You did the right thing, you made the right decision, because you see what happens when, unfortunately, people in this kind of situation don't have the comfortable conditions that they need to be in. Yeah. An interesting question. I would say that's probably not so safe to leave your car on, right? No, not monetary loss. I would think just safety. I don't think it's safe to leave your car running. Am I wrong?
Keep moving.
What? Yeah.
Engage back into the gear and keep moving.
Put it in park and then just leave it.
I don't know. Yeah.
I have a somewhat uncomfortable question, right?
No problem.
A couple of times you mentioned if Jewish life is above everything. Can I ask why you specifically underline Jewish life?
So that's a very good question.
More than one. Say, like, if you have to violate Shabbos to save a Gentile.
Mm-hmm. So that's a very, very important question. And that question is one that is a very sensitive one, but it's an important one. We don't shy away from sensitive halachic questions. So the Gemara discusses, what happens when you have a situation? What time do we have till?
1:39.
Okay, so we still have time. So the Gemara discusses... The Gemara discusses what happens when you have an avalanche and a house falls down or something happens and you have a bunch of people stuck under the rubble. So the Gemara says it's going to involve Chilul Shabbos. I'm going to have to drive a tractor to remove the rubble to get the people out. Certainly going to be Chilul Shabbos involved. The question is, what am I allowed to do? What am I not? So let's say, for example, I don't know that there's anyone in the building. I have no record of the fact that there's anybody there. Do I have a right to bring the tractor just because maybe I'll find somebody there? Says the Gemara, yes. If I know, says the Gemara, that somebody was there, but I am assuming they're dead because they were on the first floor and a 10-story building fell on top of them. What's the likelihood they're alive? Doesn't matter. You bring the tractor, you go do whatever malacha has to be done in order to save the person's life, potentially to save the person's life. Says the Gemara, and you're also allowed to do it if it's a Safek Yisrael, Safek Kusi. If I'm uncertain about whether or not it's a Jew or a non-Jew, I'm also allowed to go. Now the implication of that Gemara is that if you're certain that there's only a non-Jew in the building and there's no one else there, the implication of that Gemara would be that you do not have a right to bring the tractor, you do not have a right to be Mechal Shabbos under those kinds of circumstances. And this is something that is very controversial because that was the adopted opinion until still the days of the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim lived in the 1930s, 1920s, and he still adopted that opinion that on Shabbos we do not have the right to be Mechal Shabbos, to violate the laws of Shabbos, to save the life of a non-Jew. Now that does not mean that we don't value the life of a non-Jew. That's not what it means. What it means is that we value Shabbos more than perhaps we value the life of a non-Jew. That psak has been completely transformed. And nowadays we do not accept that opinion at all. Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and all the other greats of the last generation all were in agreement that this is not any longer the accepted or adopted opinion. And now we assume that one would have to do the same, whether it was a life of a Jew or a life of a non-Jew, one would have to do the very same to save the life of a Jew or a non-Jew equally. That's based on a whole series of proofs that they brought and reasons why they thought they were correct, but that is generally the adopted opinion. So if you have right outside of your house, God forbid, there's a car driving, they get in a big accident, you happen to be a paramedic, what are you going to say? It's Shabbos and therefore I shouldn't go, I shouldn't take the ambulance, I shouldn't get the person the help that they need. So that's certainly not the adopted opinion nowadays. Let's just try and move forward a little bit. On Yom Kippur, we have the same kind of question. We have on Yom Kippur sometimes a person who's in a situation where they're not able to fast, for whatever reason. Their condition doesn't allow them to fast. And the question is, sometimes people approach a rabbi or they'll say, you know, I'm uncomfortable, how can I eat on Yom Kippur? Yes, I know I have this condition, but... Now, number one, let's just make clear. When we say that somebody who's not well has a right to eat on Yom Kippur, that does not just mean if their not wellness is going to cause them to die on Yom Kippur by fasting. That's not what it means. My father actually knows somebody who didn't understand the halacha properly. And He asked the doctors, my wife is very sick. If she fasts on Yom Kippur, is she going to die on Yom Kippur? And they said, of course she's not going to die on Yom Kippur. They said she'll die earlier than she otherwise would. She'll die in 5 days from now instead of dying in a week from now. But she's not going to die on Yom Kippur. And he thought, well, as long as you're not going to die on Yom Kippur, that means you have to fast. That's a major mistake. That's a tremendous error. And that does not mean that a person is obligated to fast just because they're not going to die on Yom Kippur. If it's going to affect the person's life, we tell you do not fast. Absolutely do not fast on Yom Kippur or on Tisha B'Av or anything else. So here's the problem. You had one of the great giants in the 1800s to the beginning of the 1900s by the name of the Shem Mishmuel. He was the son of the great legendary Avnei Nezer. So he had a son-in-law who was very sick. I don't know exactly what his condition was. And before Yom Kippur, he pens a letter to his son-in-law about the fact that he's instructing him that he absolutely must eat on Yom Kippur because your condition does not allow you to fast. And he writes to his son-in-law, you'll read it later on your own, it's number Gimel here. He writes to his son-in-law, Chalila l'chala hachmir, God forbid that you try and fast on Yom Kippur. You are not allowed to. And he goes on and he says that you should not feel uncomfortable about this because, he says, this is your obligation, this Yom Kippur. This is your mitzvah. If God instructs you to look after your life, that means look after your life and don't follow the laws of Yom Kippur this year. I want you to eat, and that's actually what God wants you to do this year. And he writes to him in the end, he ends off the letter, the last line, he says, "Evechein and therefore, echol b'simcha l'achmecha." Don't cry over the bread that you have to eat on Yom Kippur. You should be happy because you are performing God's mitzvah this year on Yom Kippur by eating. U'shasei b'leiv tov yenecha, ki kvar ratza ha'elokim es ma'asecha. Because God has listened to you. This is what God expects you to do. This is what God wants you to do. And that's something that I have found to be a very important perspective. Like Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach pointed out, when we have the opportunity to perform a bris milah on Shabbos, do you ever see anybody who's crying while we're doing the bris milah? Why should you cry? What do you mean? But we're being mechallel Shabbos. Yeah, but you're performing the mitzvah that God asked you to do. This is what God asked you to do this Shabbos. God asked you to perform the bris milah. Do you see them all standing there and crying, oh, I can't believe it, I'm being mechallel Shabbos? Of course not. That's your mitzvah. And therefore, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, why should a person who's not well and has to eat on Yom Kippur feel bad? This is what God expects you to do. That's like doing a bris milah on Shabbos. Why should a person, a member of Hatzalah, who's saving the life of others, feel bad about the fact that they are not able to keep Shabbos like everybody else does because they have to drive almost every Shabbos some patient who needs their help? That's like doing a bris milah on Shabbos. Why would you cry about that? You're engaged in the greatest mitzvah you can ever do, in saving a life. So let's just close with a very moving letter. You look at the second side of the page, and I would ask of all of you to just Google it later on. This is a letter that was written in Bergen-Belsen in 1944. So there was a rabbi in Bergen-Belsen by the name of Rabbi Sacher Bernard Davids. I don't really know much about him, but apparently they fielded many of the questions to him throughout the years in Bergen-Belsen. And Rabbi Davids wrote this on a scrap of paper. I don't know where it was, where he got this paper from. But if you look on the internet, you'll find the original copy of this. And you see, you understand, you feel the pain of the people as this was being written. So you look at the very first line and he writes, "Lefnei achilas chametz yomer bekavanas alev." What does that mean? Before you eat the chametz, this is what you should say. So the story was, there they were stuck in Bergen-Belsen, one Pesach. Obviously they were starving with nothing to eat. And the only food that was possibly available was a few scraps of bread. And they came and they asked Rabbi Davids, what should we do? So he told them, you absolutely have to eat the bread. Yes, it's Pesach. And yes, we try to eat only matzah on Pesach. But this year we have no choice. And he wrote, he penned the following prayer that they should recite before they eat the chametz on Pesach. Look what he wrote. Avinu Shabashamayim. Hine goli v'yadua lefanecha. It is clear in your eyes. You understand. Sheretzoneinu lasos ritzoncha. That our greatest wish, there is nothing that we want more than to do your will. V'lacho geschag ha-pesach ba'achilas matzah. And we would want nothing more than to celebrate this holiday of Pesach by eating the matzah. Uv'shmiras isra chametz. And by not eating the chametz, not consuming the chametz. Ach, al zos dava libeinu, unfortunately, our hearts are pained. Shehashibud ma'akev osanu, that here we are stuck in Bergen-Belsen and we have no option. We don't have matzah. And all we have is chametz. Va'anachnu nimtzayim b'sakanas nefashos. And we are found in a precarious situation where we think that we're all going to lose our lives. And here we are, ready and prepared. Here we are standing with the chametz in our hands, about to put it into our mouths, and we say to ourselves, we are prepared to perform the mitzvah of v'chai bahem. That is what God asks of all of us, to live by the Torah, not to die by the Torah. That's what He wants us to do. V'lizayar me'azarasecha, and to follow this which You warned us, hishamer lecha u'shmar nafshecha miyod, that You told us to look after our own bodies, that we should not let our bodies rot away. Al kein, and therefore we offer to You the following prayer, tfilasenu lecha. Shetechayenu, we ask that You give us life. Uskai meinu, and You continue to keep us strong and to keep us here. Usiga aleinu b'mehera, and You should bring us our redemption. Lishmar chukecha, that we should have the opportunity to follow Your laws. V'lasos ritzoncha, and to follow Your wishes. Ula'avdecha b'leivav shalem, amen. It's a powerful tefillah, it's a powerful prayer. But there were Jews throughout the generations who had to violate various aspects of Torah life for whatever reason, for their circumstances that they were placed in. And whenever we have a situation like that, I told the people who were in the car with me that Shabbos, that we were, so to speak, being Mechal Shabbos for these sick children, I told them to think the very same. Don't be uncomfortable that you find yourself driving a car on Shabbos and doing something you otherwise would not have done. This is what God asks of us. Let's use it as an opportunity to ask for His mercy. Shetechayenu, that You should give us life, and You should give us the opportunity to appreciate life. You should give us the opportunity to continue to give to others and to bring joy and happiness and health to others, because that's what life is all about. And that's what Meir's life was all about. It was the life of giving of himself to other people in so many different ways. And the amount of times that he, so to speak, had to violate the Shabbos in order to save the life of others should be a legend for all of us to remember. It should be a blessing for his neshama. It should be something that should carry all of us and should give us a perspective of, this is what God asks of you. V'chai b'hem v'lo sheyamas b'hem. This is what God wants and expects of all of us. To do whatever has to be done to strengthen and to bolster the lives of other people in any way that we possibly can. So as we commemorate the Shloshim, as we commemorate the incredible legendary life of Meir Weiss, and we think about what he left over to the world, we think about the incredible acts of kindness that he was involved with. We think about all the times that he had to do things that he may have been uncomfortable doing, but he did it for the sake of other people, and he went out of his way just to bring happiness and joy to other people. And we are assured, as Eliyahu HaNavi teaches us in the Gemara, that one who spends a lifetime doing that for others and bringing happiness and joy to other people is a person who, without a doubt, is a Ben Olam Haba. That's a person who has an absolute ticket to Olam Haba. We hope that his family, as we mentioned, should have only besuras tovas, only wonderful things going forward in their lives. They should only have the opportunity to celebrate, and together with all of us, we will be celebrating with you. And they should all feel comfort in the fact that all of the acts that he was involved in his life are acts that made the Ribono Shel Olam proud, are acts that made him so happy, because there's nothing greater than to give a meaning and a purpose and health and happiness to the lives of other people who live around you and in your community, who you have affected. So, now we will continue on with benching and with mincha.